Okay. I was in my office preparing for Ash Wednesday as well, and it came over, I don't know, some of the social media that kind of pops up all the time on my phone or my computer. I looked away and kind of like you, in disbelief with a prayer, and I set it aside for a minute, maybe an hour or two or three, until we came into the service that night. And it was the most important thing that we could do was to begin to grieve as we began Lent. And the grieving has continued.
Josh?
I don't remember where I was. I just remember seeing it on my phone and just being incredulous, like that surreal feeling like, wow, can't believe this happening again.
Derek?
I was at the Capitol because it was session. And honestly, my first thought was 9/11. I remember thinking to myself, we'll never forget this. Because I didn't hear it right away. When I finally got it, yeah. I was in a committee meeting, and it was kind of made known. And it took a moment of silence, and I went on my phone to look. And that was my first thought. It would be one of those days you never forget.
I didn't know about it until I got home on Wednesday nights. That was a Wednesday. And on Wednesday nights, I teach part of our teen group here at Temple. And I got home and saw it on CNN, and my first thought, and by the way, I'm going to be very blunt today, my first thought was, crap, we got to do this again. So now I want to ask you, Ernie, first question. It's
no,
fine, voice, it's fine.
It gives you something to play with. I'm good with it. Thank you, though.
All right. Ernie, first question is, did you know Nicholas Cruz?
Yep. I had Nick when he was a freshman. He was just another kid. Wasn't anybody, didn't raise anything special, was a C-type student, quiet. I never have issues with kids anyway, so I tend to get some really interesting children, but for some reason, kids listen when I talk, and at the very least, if they don't do well for me, they behave well, and he was the same thing.
So there was nothing in terms of the way he acted in your class that would have indicated anything to you about what would happen later, you know, years later?
No. Actually, the next year I had his younger brother, and his younger brother set off some red flags for me more than the older brother did.
Interesting. So now we get to the February 14th, Valentine's Day. And first thing I heard, I think we've all heard, that there was a fire drill, or supposed to be a fire drill that day, that kind of confused things a little bit. Would you explain that?
Okay. Earlier in the day, that day we started regular. We had a staff meeting, individual departments, and our assistant principal came in and said, you know, there's going to be a fire drill today. We haven't had our code red drill, but it's coming up sometime in the near future. He couldn't tell us when, but sometime in the near future. So, no big deal. First fire drill happened around 10. Yay! Fire drill alarm goes off. Practices, everyone leaves. And then we just had a new system put in place, so I had a specific place I had to go, and we tried this new thing, and it took us probably 20 minutes to do a fire drill, which should only be about 10 minutes. But it was a new thing, so okay, sweet. So the fire drill, first one, no big deal.
So now tell us where you were when the incident actually started, and what happened when it started, and what happened.
Okay, so last period of the day for me on Silver Days is personalization. It's kind of like a study hall. So I had my personalization class in my room, did some paperwork stuff I had to get done first, so I was sitting at my desk grading papers. Kids were doing work or not, being kids. And around 2:20, we hear the fire alarm goes off. Again, fire alarm goes off, means you leave the room. No big deal. I'm like, okay, two in the same day. A little unusual, but we do have a culinary department that has set off the fire alarm on more than one occasion. Saying that, the culinary person is a really close friend of mine. It's not her fault. But, so I'm like, okay, no big deal. All my kids leave the room. I'm the last one out. I walk down to the left, down to the stairwell, and that's when I first started hearing gunshots. As a person who grew up around firearms, I hunt, all that, I know what a gun sounds like. And All of a sudden, all the kids start coming back, running back frantically. So I'm at the end of the hallway. I start trying to shepherd kids in the room. I seriously had my hands out kind of like this going, go into a room, get into where you belong, go where you belong, get into a room, find cover. And I'm walking slowly back towards my room. At the time I got about even with my doorway, the shooter is up on my floor and shooting. So that's instantly, most kids were able to duck into a room, teachers shut the doors. While this is going on, a couple kids are still trying to get in the bathrooms are locked, so they couldn't get in. And that's when, in my mind, I'm thinking this is a drill still. Because what I see is I see an adult male, I'm just guessing, with an AR-15, wearing a vest with a gas mask on. I assumed police officer shooting blanks. I realized it wasn't blanks when one of my former students, who just came out of the area trying to get in the bathroom, got shot and died. His name was Joaquin Oliver, about 6 feet from me. That's when I realized, oh, damn. And that's when I looked up, and the shooter trained his gun at me. That's when I grabbed all the kids that were in front of me and shoved them in right by my door. By our doors, there's a little alcove, probably about 2 feet deep. And I grabbed all the kids that were in front of me, pushed them in there, and that's when he was shooting at me. In the process, I got grazed on my cheek and on my hip. Nothing big, thank God. But then he kept shooting. I only heard one shot, but I saw the wall pop in three or four different places. Then the shooting stopped. So I peeked my head around the corner, had his gun up, and was fiddling with it. That's when I looked at my kids and yelled, run. All the kids that were in front of me ran. I followed behind them, figuring that if he figured out his gun, at least me being the small version of human that I am, could protect the kids as I were running down. I get to the top of the stairs. There's two doors on the top of the stairwell. My kids are running down the stairs. I put my foot in front of the closest one because, in my mind, he saw us run. He's going to chase. I'm glad I did because he did. I put my foot by the door so he couldn't push through. He couldn't see me because, again, being the extra small person of human, I leaned away from the window so I knew he couldn't see me from the window. He tried pushing through three times. He couldn't get through. I later found out from somebody who had to watch the tapes, he then looked through the window, and unfortunately there was a girl on the ground right there. So then he disappeared. He just stopped trying to push through the door. I counted 1,001, 1,002, 1,003. Then I ran because I knew my kids were down, that were out with me in the hallway. My kids were down, and now it's time for me to hide. So I went down the second floor and hid in the bathroom because I knew there was a staff back bathroom that had a lock on it. I waited then for the police to come clear the room. They cleared the room, but they didn't open the bathroom, so I didn't go anywhere because, well, I heard the radios, but uh-uh. So 10 minutes later, I'm like, probably should leave. Walked out, hands up, saw a deputy who I recognized since I work all the games and my wife and I are really active on campus. He's like, what are you doing in there? I was like, hiding. And he's like, we cleared that room. Mm-mm. Hiding in the bathroom still. He's like, all right, go like this, walk down the stairs. And since I was in the west end of the building, they had me exit the building on the first floor through the east end. And thankfully, I didn't see any kids on the ground, but I did see more shell casings than I thought I heard. And the thing that stuck with me the most after that was the smell, because it reeked of gunpowder, and it was hazy, because crews shot through walls.
You've now heard an eyewitness account of exactly what happened, of a teacher of the students. In the 2 months since then, a movement has arisen that has been led, driven by students. That movement has spent significant time in Tallahassee. They spent significant time with the legislators. So I want to ask my panelists first, before I come back to ask Ernie a couple more questions. What are your impressions of the movement that these students have have led. What are the impressions that you have drawn from the last couple of months? And I won't call on anybody. I'll let anybody talk.
Well, I'll start. I was with you, Jack, when the kids, the Parkland kids, students came up for the very first rally. And we were going to be on the platform with Faith and Public Works. So we were downstairs with the teachers, the kids, the ones that were going to be speaking. And it was a little chaotic, but they were trying to get everybody organized. And I think it must have been one of the teachers that was with them was making a list and saying to the students, okay, are you ready to speak? Oh, you're going to go first. Are you ready to speak? Okay, you're going to go second. Are you ready to speak? Okay, you're going to go third. And then at the end, it came to one of the guys, and I wish I could remember his name, and said to him, do you think you're going to be able to do it? You were saying you might want to speak, but you weren't sure you're going to be able to do it. What do you think now? He goes, yeah, I think I'm going to be able to do it. This is so real and so raw. So I was honored to be there that day and see the courage that they had. So close to the time when they saw their classmates killed and they had been a part of that. They were so brave. So I think I'm impressed, certainly. I'm impressed at the way that they've continued to carry on. And I'm just totally appalled that anyone could ever say that they were actors or that they were being co-opted by anybody, another human being, a political party. I was an eyewitness to what I saw that day, and it was real. It was real passion. It was real grief. It was real pain, and it was real determination. And praise God for that.
Other thoughts from my fellow panelists? Derek?
I'll use the word impactful, and I'll say that for two reasons. First and foremost, because I had a chance to kind of see it from the end when as you know, publicly they were making it known when the bus was going to come up from South Florida and they were going to arrive at Leon. And the superintendent had basically given permission for kids to take off, things of that nature. My kids go to Florida High, and so Florida High had also given the kids permission to take off as well. And on Facebook Live, some of the kids were broadcasting where they were. And so impactful because you kind of saw the momentum really riding up north of Florida. And so when the kids arrived here, and I wasn't there tonight, but when they arrived here, you can kind of see there were kids they never met before who had been impacted and wanted to be a part of it. First thing. Secondly, I say impactful because I was in the Capitol the day of the march, and I was there after the march dispersed, and the kids were now meeting with legislators. And I had a meeting with a particular senator, and I remember going in there, and the room was packed, and I had a scheduled meeting. But I remember these young people on phones, and you could tell they were actually being interviewed by several national outlets. And when I say impactful, it's because unlike many marches you may see even in our city, the determination, the focus, and the singular goal was uniform. Nobody was jockeying to be anything. They were all focused on the end game. And to me, that's very impactful because most marches or most rallies that we hear about, they disseminate in a matter of hours or days because the core value. And I think about that going back even to civil rights movements is you understand there's a cost to what you're doing and there's some sacrifice that you make. And you watch this. I'll use a word also of proud, but I'll say proud in this regard that these teenagers didn't wait for permission from the adults or the elected officials to do what they felt needed to be done. And for me, the impactful and proud are great moments in that regard. And it's unfortunate of the circumstance, and I'm not taking a lot of that, but to see it and to continue to see what's going on is absolutely amazing. I had a chance to watch, I think it was 60 Minutes when they were interviewed, and I can't remember the young man's name, but he mentioned, they asked him, are you guys being offered money? And his response was, and he said, yeah, he said people are offering us money, things of that nature. Politicians are asking us to endorse them. We were not doing the endorsements. And for me, as a guy in politics, that was a great moment because you never want to prostitute the purpose for the dollar signs. And for me, that was a great moment. It goes back to being impactful and being proud.
Any other thoughts?
I think it was encouraging just to see how engaged they were on an in a day and age where we consider the selfie generation so self-absorbed, and I'm not saying that this has cured them of that, but to see that there is that capacity to be engaged in something beyond just the 2 feet that they occupy, you know, I think that was very encouraging.
Hey, and Jack, I'm sorry, if I could just insert this, and it's something that my 12-year-old son talked about having seen pictures. And it was interesting to hear from a 12-year-old, but the one thing that he pointed out was when you looked at the crowd at the Capitol, he wasn't there, but he saw pictures, is there wasn't a concern about race. And that was a big thing that my son noticed, how multicultural the gatherings were. And it's interesting to think about that because the cause was bigger than anything else.
So you mentioned selfie, which I need to remind Barbie, Liz, and the panelists, we all need to get pictures with Ernie when we're done with the program. So, got to do our selfies, so let's not forget that, please.
So we don't outgrow that. Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. Ernie, let me ask you, let me qualify first. We've had, let's go back to about 20 years ago, the shooting at Columbine. There was no movement that started then, okay? We have had numerous, I can't even list them, not just in schools, but I mean at the Pulse nightclub, at the concert in Las Vegas. What's different now? Why did these students start this?
It's interesting you brought the selfie generation because it's the instant gratification. Our kids want something done now, and if they don't get it, they don't take no. These kids will sit... They will sit there and negotiate for 1 percentage point. Right, Matt? 1 percentage point. And they will not take no for an answer. So the idea that people think that these kids are going to go away on something that affects them and their peers on such a visceral level is laughable to me. Because these kids are lucky, and they admit that they're lucky, in that they come from affluent neighborhoods. They have parents who are willing to support them, not just with emotional support, but with financial support. And because of that, they're not going away. And their ability to use social media. If you follow some of these kids and what they're posting and how they react to people who are attacking them, it is astonishingly adult. One of my kids, Cameron Caskey, my wife had him. My wife's also a teacher at Douglas, too. Anyway, I was talking to him soon afterwards, and he said, you know, I like Twitter better because the death threats on Twitter are less vivid.
Wow.
Because you can only, it's limited. And I was like, and in my head, I'm like, how do I respond to that? But these kids are able to. And because of that, hopefully, with people also willing to support and talk about it, we will have some change. I fully believe that's going to happen, and in a positive light.
I want to ask my fellow clergy members, one of the themes that I've heard, I participated in two of the rallies on the Capitol steps, just follow this so closely since day one. And one of the themes of this movement is saying, stop with your thoughts and prayers. Stop the thoughts and prayer. We don't want that. Stop that. So I want to ask my fellow clergy, what's your reaction to that feeling by the students about the hell with thoughts and prayers?
No.
Well, I'll jump on that one. You know, I'll jump right in there. So first and foremost, I'm not going to cease in thoughts and prayers, but I totally understand and respect why they're saying it. Because here is the fact of the matter that I would argue. For the most part, you can say I'm praying for you and convince yourself that you've done enough. Yeah. And you're satisfied with that statement. What these young people are saying is, no, we don't want that. Especially if that's all you're going to offer up. And so I have no problem with that at all because this I wouldn't even say a movement. This focus, this drive, this passion is really a shifting that's taken place, and it's taken place from a generation. The teacher, as I think rightfully mentioned, is used to pressing and getting what they want. And so in the faith community, you can look at many things. Most social media posts after something horrific happens is, I'm praying for you. You're in my thoughts and prayers. And you can feel good about yourself once you say it. I know I've done it at times, and you feel like you've met your requirement. But I have an aunt who always says that, you know, when you get done praying, get up off your knees and get to work. Right. I think that's kind of what it comes down to is after you've given your thoughts and prayers, then what? Because these kids are at the then what stage. They're at the working stage. They're not at the standing still stage. And so I can still offer up my thoughts and prayers and still pray in that regard. But, you know, they're forward moving. And in that regard, you have to be mindful of that and have to respect that point.
Tim?
I don't really have anything different to say. So, yeah, okay. Right. I'm with him.
I'd like to add something then.
Sure.
When you say you're in our thoughts and prayers, it's very easy and it's not very controversial. Mm-hmm. When you say, or your church council chair says, we need to address gun violence as a congregation, and several families leave because they consider that to be political. You understand there is a risk. It's a small risk in some sense, a couple of families, which makes me sad. But it's safer for politicians and pastors and leaders to just do nothing but say, you're in our thoughts and prayers. And that's not enough for me anymore as a pastor, and it's not enough for most of our congregations.
Well, it is, you know, the same principle. If it was a personal tragedy, if there was a family in your congregation who had a house fire and lost everything they owned, you don't go, you know, according to James's epistle, you don't say, be warm and well fed. You've got to do something about it. And so I think that's that balance is that I don't think the solution's going, well, sorry for the thoughts and prayers, I won't think about you and I won't pray for you, you know, but it's recognizing, putting, you know, action to it. But I think from a faith standpoint, it's ultimately, at least for me, it's recognizing God's sovereignty in these circumstances and situations, and he's the one that I'm imploring to really make things happen. I want to be obedient to do my part, but I understand I can't do this on my own.
Josh, I know I'm not moderating, but so do you see God moving through this movement? Do you see God's hand in this sort of phenomenon?
Things like that. One, I'm going to say he's still sovereign regardless. So I think he's sovereign even in tragedy. He's sovereign. So I also believe he's sovereign in the peace that comes afterwards. But as far as what his purposes are, you know, I try to be a little bit more cautious. You know, and hindsight's a little clearer on some of those things.
I'm going to read some statements that have been thrown out in the media. And anybody, I'm going to read a statement that's been thrown out in the media. If you have a reaction to it that you want to express, anybody on the panel, you too, Ernie, say it. Say your reaction. If you don't have a reaction, fine, I'll move on to the next statement. So we don't have to drag this out too long, but I want to read these through and see if it draws any reactions from you. Statement number one. Many in the media love mass shootings. I'm not asking your reaction, I'm asking your hand. Anybody want to comment?
A comment.
I knew you would.
I haven't said anything yet. And not because I disagree, but I agree.
But I was, you know, it's just this. It's a statement like, it's just absolutely amazing. It really is. It's any to me that is anything to tear it down is being said. Versus understanding and realizing, and I'm gonna draw a comparison, it's a bad one, but I'm gonna draw it. The Colin Kaepernick kneeling had nothing to do with Parkland. Don't get me wrong, but whenever you forget why he started doing what he did and make it something totally different, and that's kind of what's going on here. Is statement like that is you're literally trying to take it away from the purpose. These kids actually lived through a trauma. The victims, they knew, and so I think that's just, man, that's just wow. Dumb was a nice word. Excuse my language.
Yeah, he said crap. You're okay.
That's what Jack said, crap, so I'll take
it. Yeah, you're okay.
Ernie, I'd like to ask you to describe the conversation that's going on among the students at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School right now, post the shooting, in terms of, is everybody in agreement there?
We're a school of 3,300 kids. There's no way that everyone's going to agree. And the thing that's been really interesting and positive in my perspective, at least what I've seen, is the kids who don't agree with each other don't yell at each other, don't scream at each other, because they don't agree with each other politically, spiritually, or whatever else, they do all want change. It's how what the difference is, what change they want, but they do want to change. So they do agree that change needs to happen. What change needs to happen is lots of difference. But it's interesting to watch. I primarily have freshmen. I have one class as juniors and seniors, and that's a definitely different level of conversation going on. But even with my freshman kids, who are 14 and 15 years old, they're starting to talk about stuff like this, which is nice but sad. Mm-hmm. It's nice because I'm glad to see that they're aware. It's sad because they have to be. But there is a lot of conversation going on.
So now I actually want to invite somebody else to come up. I want to invite Matthew Harris. Matthew, first of all, on a personal level, is the grandson of dear friends of Audrey's and mine. He happens to be a freshman at FSU, and Matthew graduated from Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School last year. He's now a freshman at FSU. His sister, of course, experienced the shooting. Matthew is also one of the organizers of the March for Life.
For our lives, that
happened here. Matthew, here. Okay. Thanks. So first I'd like you to read the poem that your sister wrote.
Yeah. Okay, so my sister is a sophomore at Marjory Stoneman Douglas, and she was in a closet for two hours, you know, during the shooting. And she wrote a poem afterwards. She writes a lot, called "None of This Is Normal." So I haven't written about it yet, maybe because writing was one of the things that felt normal to me, but nothing about this feels normal. Seeing my classmates on the news and being asked for interviews and having celebrities tweet my town's name, none of it feels normal. While in the closet, my body shook uncontrollably. I held the hands of my friends and tried to hold in my tears because I didn't want to think about who wouldn't see their loved ones these following years. My heart is racing. My insides are aching. I'm angry. I'm sad. But I am grateful that I am alive and hungry for change and for my school, for me, for my community. I'm filled with so much pride. None of this feels normal, but with a broken heart, I know all of this is true. And for each angel that was brutally ripped from us, everything from now on is for you.
That's good.
Matthew read that at the rally on March 24th on the Capitol steps. Matthew, you were one of the organizers.
One of them, yes. I had a lot of help.
So tell me how you got involved in that.
Yeah, so I guess when it was announced that there was going to be a March for Our Lives, I went to the first march in Tallahassee on February, right, you know, a week after the shooting. And I knew a lot of the kids who spoke, and I was at Leon High School, actually, when they came up, and I was able to see some of my old teachers. I really, in high school, I started the politics club at Stoneman Douglas with one of my best friends, and, you know, we've hosted in the past our conference.
All right, Matthew, I'm going to ask you to give the microphone back to Stephanie so she can plug it in a little bit and get it charged up. In a few minutes, we're going to... and then stay up, because if anybody wants to ask questions... And maybe you'll share with... No. Derek, stay there. Oh, okay. Great. Thanks, Derek. I have one or two more questions for the panel, and then we will open up for questions from you. And we might go back and forth a little bit to take a couple questions or thoughts from... Questions, not thoughts. Questions.
Or prayers.
From you. But we may then come back here. So, actually, my next question is really... initially for Ernie, but I'd like to get thoughts from anybody up here if they want. And that is one of the most controversial suggestions that's been kind of part of the legislation passed, you know, here in Florida, is the thought that there should be an option to arm teachers, that those teachers who are trained should be allowed to carry guns into school. So I want to ask, you are a teacher, and you actually know how to shoot a gun. So I know that because of our breakfast this morning. What are your thoughts on that approach?
I think it's about the worst idea possible. Now, I understand where a lot of people are coming from. Where it would be ideally if you're really trained or something. Me, personally, I grew up around firearms all my life. I've actually been a fire, like, hunter safety instructor. I have them in my house now. Arming teachers, people who have the responsibility to help craft a mind. Having a firearm on me or in my room even would limit my ability to do that. I'm an affectionate person. I like being close to kids. If you need me to come talk, I have a line around my desk. The Mr. R zone. You don't come into the zone, because if somebody wants to come in and talk to me, I want them to feel we have a little bit of private space so I can have that conversation. If I have a firearm on me, that would never happen. Hugs would never happen. Because I wouldn't want a kid, A, figuring out that I have a firearm on me, or B, being afraid of me because I have one. Also, if I have a firearm on me, do they respect me? Or do they fear the firearm? And my wife and I have talked about this a lot. And if they do arm teachers, I'm moving. I'm going to go somewhere else where they don't. Because it's not the answer. I'm not saying that armed security or something like that is a bad idea. I'm saying arming teachers is a bad idea. And also, the amount of money that has been bandied about, from what I've heard from politicians, is laughable. In order to have life and death in my hand.
I have one question for the clergy on the panel, and then we'll open up for questions from all of you. And look at these issues. Arming teachers, arguments over the Second Amendment, arguments over what kind, if any, of gun laws should be passed. If you go through each of these issues, or security in schools, the saying that each side actually accusing the other side of being insensitive to the needs of the students, all of this actually is a great example of the awful political in your bubble divide that's in our country. It is. It's an example of what is truly wrong here now. So my question to each of you is, clergy, what can we do to address this?
The shooting or the climate?
The climate.
Well, I think realistically, I think what we have to do is what we're doing right now. And I think we have to start locally. And I think one of the consequences of social media and our news and everything else is that it gives this global feel. And it's a hard burden for me to, when I watch the news, which I don't watch much anymore, read, and try to limit that to somewhat for my sanity as well. But again, it can be overwhelming, right? I mean, and I think what I find is that most people want to do something, and whether it's this issue, guns, school shootings, world hunger, whatever it is, or just the divide in our country, the divisiveness that we see, it's so burdensome. Like, what can I possibly do? Well, I prefer then to say, well, where am I right now? And who are the people in my life? And what is the circle of influence that I have? And what can I do there? I'm not in a position currently, hopefully never, that I can influence the whole world or the country or even the state. But what I can do is influence the people in my circle, which is over at Florida State and my cathedral parish and the people I interact with. And right here, you all right here. And so I think that's the first thing that we can do is right here locally, how am I becoming the change? How can we respect one another, listen to one another, have these kind of relationships, as you said earlier, that we can disagree with one another and because we respect each other. We have a relationship ahead of time. I think we can be an example for that. I think that's what I set my sights on.
So, others, please. Especially, what can we do within our congregations or within our community?
I think it's a lot of the themes that we go back to again and again in our discussions and with this panel, and I think Tim summarized it nicely. It's just that sense of, in some respects, modeling, you know, how we model it up here, but even how we model it within our congregations when we have conversations with folks that we know we disagree with and may disagree with passionately and fundamentally with, that we not demonize the other side. That we not and I think part of that modeling, especially in the day of social media, is it's one thing if, you know, I have a conversation with you as a friend and I would never demonize you personally, but I'll retweet something that demonizes people who hold your view, or I'll like something on Facebook that, you know, paints people like you in a very negative or, you know, monolithic light. And so I think that's another one of the things where I think social media has made that increasingly more difficult, because it's just too easy to like and retweet and share without thinking about how are others going to interpret that, because I'm in effect giving tacit approval to everything that that article says or everything that that person has endorsed. But I think, you know, I'm with Tim. I think so much of it is on the small scale, being comfortable with influencing where you have, putting most of your effort to influence where you have the most influence, instead of putting this lopsided effort that I'm going to change the world through Twitter. I'm probably going to do more through my dinner table, and that's where I need to have, and I'm not neglecting the world, but I am responsible for those sitting at that dinner table.
Are you willing to house a Jefferson dinner?
My table's pretty full.
Oh, okay.
Y'all know we have 6 kids.
Where's Liz? Where's Liz? I'm trying to...
There we go. Talking about the congregation or at home?
Yeah. At home. All right, I'd like to open up for any comments, questions from the audience. So, and by the way, I have some thoughts on what I just asked, which I'll say at the end.
So as I make my way to our first comment question, I just wanted to remind everyone on our roll on very heated topics, which is no team clapping. We've noticed that sort of creates a dynamic where people don't feel free to say what they need to say. That's what's special about what we've built here, is that people can have all sorts of opinions and say them and we hear them.
How would you respond to somebody my age? I've had several people mention this to me. They said, well, how come when we were in school, we had guns, but nothing like this happened in our day. Why is it happening today?
I am with you. We've had mentally ill people. We've had guns. And you talk to people probably, you know, I know my grandparents. There's stories that in Tallahassee you used to leave your doors open before there was some murder in the 70s. So that's what I would love to get into. That would be substantial to me. I would love to know why Nicholas Cruz did what he did, without just, he's mentally ill, right? But like, let's find out, like, why is it the Vegas guy? We can't find a motive. What is going on in our country? What's going on in our culture? And I think, to be honest, I'm going to say this, and I said it to my congregation, you and I both, we all need to do penance and pray and ask forgiveness for how you and I have contributed to this culture. Because it's the music that we listen to and have allowed our children to listen to, the videos, the video games, the movies, the television that we thumbs up, that we like, the stuff that we've contributed to build this industry that's now resulting in a culture that continually is producing murders and the lack of values that we see. We're all responsible for that. And if we want to look to politics as the solution, I think we're looking the wrong place. We need to look right here in our hearts first.
Matthew wants to read. No more.
No clap.
No more clapping.
Thank you. Matthew, thank you. Wants appreciate to, it. Thank you.
No more. Matthew wants to respond.
Yeah, I think. Is this working?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
I think another reason is that after Columbine and when the country as a whole really failed to, give any consequences for something like that, there hasn't been any change since Columbine. And in fact, I would argue that there's been a bit of a perversion of gun culture in the United States that's really allowed people such as Nicholas Cruz to feel that it's okay to go and do something like this. And we see it all the time. We saw it in Orlando. We saw it in Aurora. We saw it in Las Vegas, in San Bernardino. It's just happening so constantly, and it doesn't stop. And I think, as an American culture, I guess, as a country, when we, like I said, when we fail to reprimand those, the people who enable this type of thing, then it's just not gonna stop. And to answer the question more specifically is, before Columbine, this didn't happen very often.
Actually it did.
Did it?
Yes.
Okay.
That's what I was gonna add to this, is the difference is not that all of a sudden we're having these incidents when years ago we didn't. I mean, I remember when I was a kid seeing on TV about some shooter at the top of a tower, I think at a school that, yeah, in Texas, yeah. And these sorts of things have happened, but here's the difference. The difference is not that the incidents didn't happen then. The difference now is that in terms of the extent of media, social media that didn't exist until the last 20 years, cable news that didn't exist until maybe the last 30 years. So the difference is in how things are communicated and the availability of information. That is the game changer. It's we know about things more now, and we know about them the minute that they happen, as opposed to incidents not happening. Okay, so next question.
Yeah, I was struck as we saw the news come out about this incident. This was directed to the teacher, by the way, and about the students. I was struck by that this could be so powerful in the movement because of the fact that, as we all know, great majority, overwhelming majority of people in the United States believe something should be done.
Right.
What it is, they might disagree on. But among the students, do you find a lot of incredulity and perhaps resentment towards adults because of the fact that they have not fixed this problem at this point and so many people want it fixed?
A lot of kids are expressing some disappointment with elected officials. Not necessarily, okay. At some of the teachers have actually ran into issue with this. Most of my kids, the biggest complaint that we have towards any authority figure is at the police, specifically BSO and the FBI. There is a lot of students who are very unhappy with them. Even now, on campus, we have a large police presence. Some of those police officers are carrying AR-15s on their backs. And the kids are unhappy about that. And the good news is that most of our kids trust adults, trust the teachers, trust the people they should, but they do want change. And if you talk to the kids, especially the seniors who are going to be voting in the next election, they're going to vote the way they think will get them the change they want. And that's very nice to see from my perspective, because voter turnout for that age bracket is shockingly low. I mean, look, the people in this room are the ones who make most of the decisions.
Next.
I'd like to suggest that, along with thoughts and prayers, we reject calling this thing a tragedy. And here's my reason. A tragedy means there's a protagonist and an inevitable force. call it a perversion. You can call it an expression of idolatry, but it's not tragic. This was not inevitable that this should happen. This is the result of a series of decisions and political policies that brought these factors together that allowed that shooting. It's not tragic. It's horrible, but it's not tragic.
Next, we have people up here. Want to ask? Keep your hands up so Liz can find you.
Ernie, I want to ask you. We've been talking a lot about what students are saying, what students are thinking, what students are doing. What's the talk in the teachers' lounge? What do teachers think needs to be done?
This is something that you're right. We've been talking a lot about it. My wife, again, like I said earlier, is a teacher at school as well, so we've been talking about it at home as well. Lots of varied opinions. Most of the biggest consensus amongst, at least again, I teach social studies, and so I go to lunch every day pretty much, and the consensus amongst most of the teachers is, yeah, there needs to be some change. Specific change that we'd like to see concerning safety is more than anything else. The gun issue is very separated, and right, it's okay. But the big thing that we want to see is, yeah, the Aaron Feist bill, $400 million for school safety. Let's start seeing some of it. Let's start seeing some of it done with some input from teachers, though. Because at least at our school right now, all the new security stuff that's been in place, they haven't asked any students, they haven't asked any teachers, they haven't asked any of the people who actually have to live with it what we want or what we think would work. So it's just been passed down. You will do this. And what we would like is a bit more say. Or, you know, somebody to come in and actually ask us and say, okay, this is what we're going to do. The communication's been very bad so far.
Thank you. This is directed to Matthew. First, Matthew, I want to tell you I'm very, very proud of you. But this is a movement, and I've seen movements come and go, and I know that all of the students in your age bracket are in school, and you're going to go on to other endeavors, and this movement might fade away. Is there an organizational structure that has a little bit of permanence, and is that also on the national level? Does that exist?
Yeah, you're right. You know, as mature as they are, is it already?
Yeah, you get.
As mature as they are, they're still, you know, high schoolers, right, and college students. So as they get into their own, you know, into their own thing, then this movement,
the movement might fade a little bit. But there is a national structure that's in the form of Every Town for Gun Safety and Moms in Action. It's been, and Giffords is another great organization, the Brady Campaign, and those are all helping, you know, the Stone Douglas kids to really make this movement happen. And the ones who organized the March for Our Lives in Washington, and Stoneman Douglas did a few trips to Washington. My sister was a part of it, where she met Joe Biden and you know, a few other really high up there people. So I think because of that support structure from Moms in Action and those other groups, I don't think this is going anywhere anytime soon.
Back there, I see.
After an incident like this, one of the responses is, and I know this was the first thing that occurs to me, is the mental health aspect. This person must be really of mental, you know, of help to do something like this. Now, you knew this young man before, and you didn't have any indication that he needed the kind of help that would have prevented this. What do we do now? How can we improve? How can we find the next guy?
Well, the thing with this young man, closer to me. Anyway, the thing with this young man is, while I didn't see it, others did. He was tracked. He was reported. We got him as much help as we could. But one of the things that is really unfortunate with the way that the school system works is, as soon as that young man turned 18, he could deny all the services that we were giving him. And he did. He said, I don't want him anymore. And when that happened, the school's hands, it changed to what it was. There, I promise you, I've seen the young man's file when we had him at school. There was a lot of people who reached out for help, who tried to offer the kid help. And some of it was accepted, but as soon as he turned 18, he said, I'm done with all of this. I don't want to deal with it anymore.
Ernie, you mentioned new safety measures over here.
I see you. Sure. The most easiest thing to be seen is the clear bags. All of our kids have to wear clear backpacks, which is what it is. My kids get extra credit if they bring in some small little thing that shouldn't be in their bag, because as long as it matches the right letter of the alphabet. By the way, when I go back, it's a C day. So, anyway. But the other things that are the biggest thing is, honestly, we have 18 police officers on campus. We have 6 FHP, 12 BSO, and there's some gates up. We actually have 2 watchtowers. And obviously the 1200 building is fenced off, and there's 4 officers at each corner at all times. So I understand what they're trying to do, and they're trying to make people feel secure. But the kids aren't, and me personally, it's hard to be on campus and not have a little bit, have that anxiousness. And a great example, I worked yesterday. 48 people walked by my door. So the idea of a clear bag making me feel more secure, nah.
And so let me actually, come in with a question of sorts, not just for you, Ernie, but for anybody up here. I think about what you just think. Everybody, think about what he just said. 2 towers. How many police?
18.
18. So we have now converted a high school into a fortress.
No, it's incarceration.
Yeah. So I don't know if it's incarceration. It's a fortress. I mean, we've created. We've created this institution that reminds me more of one of the forts from the days of the Old West than it does of a school. How does that feel?
Well, I understand why. Because people want to do something, and it's an easy thing to see. You can see the changes. You can see the police officers. And I get that, because people want to have their kids be safe. And I completely understand where it comes from. It doesn't feel good being the person on campus, though. I talk to my kids. I tell them at least once a week, all my classes. I look at them and say, thank you so much for being here. Because for me, getting out of bed and going to school is some days really hard. And I know it's got to be for them, too. So one of the things I've been trying to foster with my kids, and I try and make sure I get a chance to know my kids really well. I really make an effort. Because I'm interested in them. I'm a teacher not because I want to make crap tons of money. It's because I want to make good, people. And I want them to know that they're helping me. And I'm hoping that I'm helping them. But we need that more than we need more people walking around with badges and guns. Don't get me wrong. Most of those guys and ladies who have been on campus are fantastic. Some of them aren't. But again, they're doing a job that is, at best, for them, shockingly boring. And you know what, though? I'm really okay with it being really boring for them. Because I've seen them when they weren't bored, and that wasn't okay either. So the security, I get it. I just don't have to like all of it. And I don't want to... The fortress idea I like a lot better than the prison idea, because that's it does kind of feel that way sometimes. But it's still, again, this is the thing that, with all this security, on Tuesday when I was leaving school, I was walking out, and I saw a minivan pull in, and two ladies got out and started taking pictures. They drove by one of the FHP officers. So I walked over to them, and I said, ladies, why are you on? Hi, can I help you? Why are you on campus? Oh, we're just checking it out. So that if you want to be on campus, you have to go through the main office and get yourself checked in. Well, you just want to take... It's like, no. You're trespassing. If you want to be here, you have to be here legitimately. Then I got yelled at a bunch. That's not unusual for me. I'm kind of okay with it. But after those ladies left, I went over and tapped on the window of the police officer. I know he's got a boring job because he's just sitting at a gate. But he didn't even realize the gate behind him was open. So I may have went in and then talked to our principal. Then I may have called the troop commander for the FHP and informed him of my opinion of that officer in as polite a manner as I could. But so all this security stuff that they want to talk about, if it's going to be there, they got to do something. I will say this, though. Wednesday, when I went back to campus after I went and picked up my son from daycare, the FHP officer at the gate did stop me and ask me where I was going. So I'm not saying all of them are sitting there playing their phones, but at least one of them was.
So one back there, one.
There is an excellent example of how to deal with the divide in our nation in the Florida Humanities Council magazine forum, written by our own director, the Village Square. If you haven't seen it, it gives tips on how.
You mean to Steve Seibert, right?
And
actually, I meant to bring some in today, so I have some in the car. If you would like them, I'll grab some afterwards. I actually did not put him up to that.
It's the best set of guidelines on how to talk with people instead of two people that I have read. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see it, the Democrat. Okay, my question is, there's been a lot that's gone on in different communities to show sensitivity to the, call it incident, call it tragedy, what should not have happened at Marcus and Douglas. We've seen it here in Leon County, our city and our county taking action. Is there enough momentum, if not to change the world for the long term, to at least get us through midterm elections?
So, concisely, I think yes. I've been very, very encouraged by the outpouring of support we've gotten from all across the country. I think the march in Washington was the third largest march on Washington in American history, and which is just astounding. And I think we've seen recently through special elections and we've seen the momentum is starting to shift, whether that's because of the shooting in particular or other factors. It's a combination of all of it, and I think it's really encouraging to see what's happening. And I think just the fact that the governor signed the law that he did last month or 2 months ago is just immense. Because if you had told me 2.5 months ago that something like that would have gotten through the legislature, I would have laughed at you. Like really, I would have laughed at you. So I think that's been really encouraging. And so I hope it doesn't end after midterms. I hope it keeps going, and I plan to make sure it does. But yes, at least through midterms, there is enough momentum for that.
All right, so I'll be the cynic and say, oh, you want to be cynic too? All right, I'll go first. I'll soften them up. My concern is I think it's just going to be a matter of time before we're discussing the next tragedy, or if we don't want to call it a tragedy, the next incident that takes place. Because until we address the deep, difficult, complex, underlying causes, these little superficial Band-Aids, no offense, but adding 2 days, 3 days to a waiting period to buy a gun, please tell me how many shootings that's going to eliminate this year. Give me a number. Raising the minimum age for buying a gun from 18 to 21, the average age of these shooters and these mass shootings is 34. So that can help you sleep at night. It's not going to make a difference until we're willing to support Tim's point that he talks about again and again when these issues come up, is it's culture. It's cultural issues. It's if you look at the prevalence of broken homes in the life of the 25 sort of most significant, commonly cited shootings that we've had, 75% of those shooters came from broken homes, the vast majority of which came from severely broken homes, not just divorced. We're talking domestic violence. We're talking infidelity. We're talking serious cultural causes that and things that these young men were, these horrible circumstances that they were raised under. Until we're addressing culture, until we're addressing the violence of culture, our view of life and the cheapening of life, until we're willing to address those things, this is going to keep happening. I don't see anything that they're doing in the legislature that's going to fix those deep underlying causes. I think it's going to be long, hard work in society, not just things that are taking place at Capitol Hill. That can make us feel good that we got a bill passed and that woo-ha, but don't lose vigilance in thinking that now suddenly we've fixed it.
I will agree, but also disagree. The way I agree is that whatever was passed that Governor Scott signed, whatever was done, for example, by the county this week, whatever was done, is not going to change the game in a dramatic fashion. And we cannot put in our minds that, oh my gosh, one side is going to say, oh, we've won, and the other side is going to say, and we're going to sue them. That is not helping, and that is not the answer. And you're right that the answer is a change in culture. But here is where that ordinance does help, and here is where the bill signed by Governor Scott does help. Because the fact that we have actually made those changes and done those little steps forward is a step in changing the culture. It's changing the culture from one that idolizes guns. We live in a culture, we live in a country that idolizes guns. In Israel, so many people carry guns because they're trained, they're in the military. But you don't have those shooting incidents happening in schools. And you don't have those shooting incidents happening in play, because the culture is different. And here, we have to stop idolizing things like guns and stop giving too much power to lobbying firms. Sorry, Derek.
There you go.
And instead, we have to learn to worship the presence of God that every person has, and to respect that every person has a connection to God and has some piece of divinity in them. If we put the other junk aside and recognize that each of us is connected to the divine and make that the beginning of our discussion, then we're changing our culture. Then we're changing our culture.
Well, Jack, I have to jump in and with you, respectfully disagree with you in this regard. The bill is helpful. Ordinance is helpful. I would argue from an ordinance standpoint, they could have done this a long time ago. They could have. So I'm sorry for not being on that bandwagon. They could have done this. My concern from a political standpoint in working in this arena is two things. Number one, if you ever know anything about elections, the lower turnout for election is always non-presidential, usually gubernatorial. So this upcoming year, number-wise, is normally, traditionally, is the lowest. I'm not saying it will be this go-around, but normally it is. And so it's going to require individuals, not just in here room, but outside of this room, actually going to the polls and actually utilizing that right to vote. Going further than that, though, here's why I'm going to be a cynic. It's because I've been around Florida politics for a long time, and this matter, I don't want to use the word tragedy, I'm sensitive to what Reverend Copeland said, it interrupted session for the right reasons. It really did. But if you talk to some of these legislators in their offices one-on-ones, some of those same guys who said, I'm with you, absolutely correct, they hit the green button, and they voted for the bill. Same ones who said, voted against the bill. Same ones who were saying we should not, they because they're dictated and controlled by a speaker more than by their constituency. And so when I don't buy into the culture, it's because I've been around it for so long that I realize that when they come back in March of 2019, they will tell you themselves, we've done a great job. I'll give you a great bill. Opioid. There's an opioid crisis in Florida and in America. They put $50 million behind it. They passed the bill. If you read the bill, you will surmise this. It is more politics than it is policy. That bill will do nothing at all. But all the parties who pushed it, by the time you realize it's fluff, they've already won their next seat. And that's when I challenge the culture, it's in that regard, is that the same ones who's pushing this movement are the same ones that have to make sure that we hold people accountable. We have to stop putting somebody in office and then letting them spend 2 to 4 years sitting in a seat not doing anything whatsoever. And I'm going to say this, it's not Republican or Democrat. You could be for Rick Scott or Bill Nelson in the U.S. Senate, but I will say this to you. You have to ask yourself, what is the individual I'm putting in office? What have they done and brought it back home that I can see the results of it? So when I challenge culture, it's because I am tired of people coming to my church asking if they can speak to my congregation when they're running for office, and then when they win the seat, I don't see them anymore. Because I have people in my congregation who are struggling every day, who worry about how they're going to eat. I don't see the county commissioner, city commissioner, the governor, the mayor. I don't see them after they win the office. So I'm not buying into the culture changing. I only buy into it is I have more confidence in this age bracket doing what they're doing than the older ones and the politician. I work around politicians every day. What they're concerned about, I had an elected official go on the floor in the House and blast every lobbyist calling us Gucci loafer wearing lobbyists. We're sorry. And he got major attention. That same night, that same representative who did that called my firm asking for money. True story. So you can't buy into what you read and what you hear them saying in front of the press, because it's all about what they say in front of the cameras. If you really want to see culture change, those of us in here, especially clergy, we got to make sure that our faith dictates our politics, not the other way around. And the problem is that, Betsy made a good point, we're losing members. Some people are losing people in their church because you are challenging status quo. And people are getting mad and they're walking out. You have to be okay with that. You have to be okay with that, because if not, we're going to have another story of somebody killing somebody else. It's going to happen. And the changing it from a three-day waiting period, I get all that. But ladies and gentlemen, this is important to understand. What are you going to do about the people who currently have guns illegally? What about those individuals? Because he said he had 48. How do you know you have 48 cross your door unless you're counting all of them? Yeah, think about that. $400 million for safety and not a teacher pay raise? This is from a conservative guy. You got to think about this. My kids spend more time with their teachers than they spend at home with me sometimes. I don't want my child's teacher having a gun, but I do want them to get adequate pay for the work they're doing. I know my children.
Preach.
Please pay them.
Preach.
So, Darren.
Can I say something?
So, Darren.
Pretty please. Pretty please.
Yes, in a second, Tim. So, Derek, actually, we're not disagreeing.
No.
We're just saying different sides of the same coin.
I'm disagreeing only in that is that when you say the culture, I don't buy in that the culture is changing yet until I actually, this election, if change is happening by way of seats moving, I may buy into it. Right now, I think it's a lot of momentum. I'm concerned that the people who need to vote, and not the students, the people who need to vote, are going to sit back and say, you know what, I'll wait until 2020 when the president's up for re-election. All That's right. My concern.
We got Tim the floor now.
I agree with both of you, and I think it's great discussion.
I need more fire from you, Tim.
It went, whoa.
I I think these issues are great. I think we need to debate gun control, and we need to be debating security in school and mental health. But again, you know, I suspect that in some ways, maybe all of us or some of us are looking to the government as a solution to the problem. And I think kind of what Derek's hinting at is that it's not. And it doesn't mean that we don't do anything. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that we don't try to do something or we just forget about it. But I do think we need, as a people, and 11, I think, of the 12 last of these shooters didn't have a father growing up. Mm-hmm. Okay? So you want to talk about the circumstances that led to that? And why is it in this country that it's the rate of children that are being born in out-of-wedlock situations, which we know has also contributed to poverty and so on, why is that increasing? We don't talk about that. We don't talk about the morality that's underneath this culture and what's going on here. And I just ask you just to search your own hearts. What are you going to watch tonight on TV, and how many hours are you going to spend watching it? And what are the values being presented that you, by watching it, are contributing to?
I'd like to say that congregations can make change and cultural change if they want to. We are doing something at Oliver Hill Community Center, South City. The community center, we're trying to bring after-school activities to kids, specifically art and music. But some of the residents have sued the community center, I don't know, a couple of times. And so the policy has recently changed, and they're not allowed to come into the center unless their parents bring them and sign them in and sign them out. But the reality is we're there because there are no parents home in the afternoons. So it's like even trying to move forward and doing something good and kind, sometimes you get disrupted. But if we can engage the four kids that are still coming because their parents are signing them in and out, it's worth it. I just want to bring it down to the small things like reading pals, you know, volunteering to teach somebody to read, showing up at something that your congregation is doing to alleviate suffering here in our town, in our city. Please volunteer when your congregation invites you to do something like that.
So true.
And by the way, here at Temple Israel, rather than watching TV tonight, come to services. All right, Liz, you have a question back there.
Can I just add?
Yeah, and I'd just like to add one thing really quickly. Well, I agree, you can't legislate culture and you can't legislate morality. What you can legislate is the ability of people like Nicholas Cruz to attain a weapon. So, like, I understand that there are these circumstances that lead to people like Nicholas Cruz being broken and wanting the ability to kill these people, to kill people in general, but if they don't have the means to do it, then they can't, you know? So
it's not either or.
I agree. It's not a binary issue.
I agree with you. I think you're absolutely, and thank you for being here too, by the way. I want to throw one more thing to you all, because I think this is a big thing. But when I talk about the culture, is the lack of values. And I don't mean, I want you just to think, what is our culture for Nick Cruz? Again, like, what did our culture offer to him? An odd looking guy who had a rough history, who probably wasn't good in grades, probably wasn't very athletic. Probably wasn't getting the ladies, I don't know. But what does our culture offer to someone like that? What does someone live for? Why is it that my students at FSU are anxious and depressed and struggling when they have so much abundance in their midst, right? Yeah. Living in luxury, they drive nicer cars than I've ever owned, they have computers in their pockets, and way more than I ever had when I was a student. why are they, there's something, we need, like, what is the meaning of your existence? What are you living for? What are you here for? We need to be addressing that, and our schools don't. We don't have philosophy classes. We don't, we're becoming slaves. We're becoming zombies. And if you don't believe me, go sit on a bench at FSU and watch everybody walking around. I'm not making fun of the college students. We're just as bad. We're probably worse off, honestly. But look, just stop and look around you at the zombies. Look at the difference between Pope Francis walking on the balcony and Pope Benedict. Everybody's looking at him in their bare eyes. And Pope Francis comes out. Everyone's holding their devices and looking the world through that. We have to really look at ourselves and do some introspection. Other than just hashtag be nice.
Well, that's the whole point of the movement, right? It's that social media is a tool for organizing, and it's a very effective one. So I agree that there's a little bit of an issue with, you know, as you put it, the selfie generation. But I think it's also been facilitating what's happening to a certain degree. And with the case of Nicholas Screws in particular, you know, my friends at Douglas tried to befriend him. I have friends who, you know, he's asked them out on dates and things like that. And one of my friends, Isabel Robinson, wrote an amazing op-ed in the New York Times called "I Tried to Befriend Nicholas Screws, but he still killed my friends." So, you know, it's not for lack of trying. Essentially, is my point. So,
yeah. All right. Do you want one more question?
I think you can. Okay. I'd like to give enough time for everybody to wrap and close up with everything.
Well, then I will wrap up and close what I'm thinking. On Facebook yesterday, as I was actually posting a video from WCTV about the children of Holocaust survivors, and since I am one, I was posting this so that basically my family could see the video, and I noticed a discussion going on and somebody else's post, and they were discussing about the gun ordinance, you know, the loophole ordinance passed by the county commission a few days ago. But the discussion wasn't really about that. The discussion was about whether Marion Hammer was telling the truth about being threatened and then not showing up. And the discussion was from two very left, very right perspectives of, oh, she's lying. No, she's not. And here's why. Look at this about liberals carrying, you know, being threatening. That was the discussion. Well, folks, that is the stupidest discussion and completely the wrong thing that anybody should be engaged in. We need to be engaged in a discussion that brings us, that in a discussion that has a eliminates the radical edges, that focuses on how we can connect on each issue. Now, does that mean we all agree? No, of course not. Of course not. Does that mean there aren't huge elements, different elements that are part of this? Absolutely. The work of Matthew and the other students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School is incredibly inspiring. It reminds me of wearing my black armband on moratorium day in high school protesting the Vietnam War. Except you guys are going to take it further, and you guys can have a far greater impact than we had, because we couldn't stop the war, but you've already got a little legislation passed. So element number one is the inspiration that our youth are giving us. Number two is something that Derek pointed out, and that is the reality of politics. And what is the culture in politics? That's a whole other conversation. But if we can push ourselves ahead, little bit by little bit, in creating a culture in which we can sit up here and have these kinds of discussions, but do it in your homes and do it with people you know, and don't just exclude out people that you disagree with. Have those conversations, then we can start to change the political culture. We need, frankly, to embrace the fact that our religious backgrounds can drive us in a positive direction. If we embrace our belief And I'm not advocating that you have to believe in a particular religion or any religion. But if you are a member of a religion and it means something to you, embrace its core. Its core is a combination of understanding the divine and understanding morality. And that should dominate your look at politics. My friends, I don't care if Mary Hammer lied or not. I could care less. What I care about is the tone of the conversation. What I care about is the ignoring of morality by either side in that conversation. And what I care about is how, if we can push forward in a more moral culture, one that doesn't idolize material things but respects humanity and our connection to divinity, then we can change. Thank you for coming. Yeah.